some people remember it and some people don't when I talk to them. I remember this, though, Superbook. It was my only foray into anime because, like, Pokemon and Digimon were off limits for me, so.
No Digimon?
Hi, folks, and welcome to Pastor's Kid, a podcast that explores life, faith, and the relationships through the eyes of those who grew up, in, out, and through the heart of contemporary religious life. I'm your host, Piper Ramsey Sumner. Today, I'm joined by Cameron Heppola. Born in Grand Rapids, Michigan, Cameron grew up in a youth pastor's home in the same city as Calvin College and Zondervan Publishing. At the age of 10, he moved to Greenville, South Carolina, where his dad continued to be a youth pastor at a non-denominational megachurch in the same city as Bob Jones University. He attended Anderson University in South Carolina, where he obtained a bachelor's degree in Christian theology. After graduating, Cameron enrolled in a master's program in philosophy and began teaching Bible and church history to middle school and high school students at First Presbyterian Academy in Greenville. Finally, deciding to pursue his lifelong dream after completing an MA in philosophy, Cameron applied to Duke Divinity School in Durham, North Carolina, where he now studies the history of evangelicalism in America. Welcome, Cameron. Thanks for being here.
Yeah, thanks for having me. I'm really excited to do this.
Yes, I'm excited too. It's very cool that we got to kind of connect online. And I'll have to ask you, do you still do TikTok?
I don't. You know, ever since I've been here in Durham and had stopped teaching, I mostly use TikTok as a sort of really for an educational tool for teaching Bible. But I don't really, I haven't posted on there. I still use it, but I haven't posted on there since being a teacher.
Yeah. I feel you. I kind of just like, I hop on every once in a while to make a video or something, but I've had to like keep the app away from me because it sucks you in. And then you like, you're like, oh my gosh, it's been 2 hours and I've been watching videos and I can't even remember what I watched.
Yeah.
It's so bad.
So true.
Yeah. Well, I got to ask you the first question, the obvious question that I ask everybody, what makes you a pastor's kid?
Yeah. So, my dad has been a pastor, as long as I've been alive and even a few years, I forget the exact number of years he's been in ministry, but, he's been a pastor for as long as I've been alive at least. And, he, as you mentioned in my bio, he's been a youth pastor or was a youth pastor for most of those years. But since we moved to Greenville, he kind of, I guess, rose to the ranks, so to speak. And he was a youth pastor there at the church. And then he became the family pastor. So he was over all the children's ministry and student ministry stuff there. And now he actually does missions and outreach stuff at that church. That's what makes me a pastor's kid. But people in ministry has like kind of always been in my family. My dad was a grandson of a pastor. My mom's the daughter of a pastor. So it's just kind of been in our blood, really. So, yeah.
That feels like a theme that I see a lot where it's a multi-generational thing, right? It's like, a lot of times it's like, and then also my dad's a pastor's kid or my mom or whatever it is. So that does tend to happen. It becomes a family affair, I guess you could say.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. For sure.
How old were you when your dad started at the mega church? Was there a big difference between the churches he was at before and when you moved to the big church?
Yeah. So, we moved to Greenville in 2006. So I was 10 going on 11. And it was the church that we were at prior when we were in Grand Rapids was, you know, pretty much everybody in Grand Rapids or in Michigan in general. There's a huge Reformed population, Dutch Reformed population in Michigan in general, especially in Grand Rapids. So we were at a Reformed church there, and it was kind of a, I guess you would call it like a church revitalization or a church replant kind of deal. There was a Fuller Seminary grad who had been in ministry for many years. He was probably in his 40s, but he had graduated from Fuller, and he was kind of revamping this church that my dad was the youth pastor at. And he actually, that's that he was writing and ghostwriting and editing for Zondervan. So yeah, there's a lot of, there's a bit difference in terms of size, I guess, between, it wasn't a mega church by any means in Michigan, but it was the same sort of like evangelical culture was present mm-hmm. in both.
Similar vibe, but just one was way bigger.
Yeah, definitely. Yeah.
Bigger, more complicated, I feel like. Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, what would you say, you know, maybe comparing your upbringing as a pastor's kid to other kids, how do you think that the life of a pastor's kid is unique?
Yeah, you know, I was thinking about that question because I think my mind immediately in thinking about that question went to, oh, well, you're just under the radar a lot. And I think I thought about it more. And in thinking about the question of what makes us unique, I don't know that that's necessarily true. Cause I don't know. My mind immediately goes to like politicians' kids, like the Obama daughters or somebody, like they also are under the radar in some, you know, national or even global sense, really. So, you know, I think that's where my mind immediately goes, but yeah, I guess what makes pastors' kids unique in that sense is that you add religion into the mix, which can certainly complicate things. It's one thing to be in a, you know, the formative years of your life and be under the radar, but then when you add, you know, the behavior and the, you know, the sorts of things that the ethos that comes along with religion, it just complicates it more. So I think the sort of like meeting of those two things, I guess, is what makes pastors' kids unique. Yeah.
Right. Yeah. Because I think people, if people that aren't religious don't really think about how much that religion for people who are religious is all like can be all encompassing. And when you're in those worlds, like I think especially with some of the more kind of the bigger mega churches, there's enough programming and enough kind of money and entertaining things that could be your entire life, you know? And so everything is inside of this bubble. I use that term a lot, at least I used to like the idea of like living in a bubble. Like, you know, I went to a Christian school and then I went to a Christian college. And so I was always in the, specifically for me, Nazarene bubble, you know, it's like the world didn't really exist outside of that. But then there was that extra layer of the like religious part where if you made mistakes, it wasn't just like, oops, it was like, oh no, there's like, you have some kind of spiritual deficiency, you know? And, yeah. And then add being just a pastor's kid, you get like that expectation that you have to be like this perfect holy child or whatever, you know?
Yeah. And in thinking about like your previous question, like the difference between the mega church versus the church that we were at in Michigan, like being smaller. Yeah. I don't know which one would be worse. In terms of that, right? Like being under the radar, like, I don't know if it like, I guess it would probably depend on the person, but like, I'm, you know, you think about like, a smaller community is more tight knit. So like everybody knows each other and like, there's that sort of like, I don't know, this sort of tight knit nature of it, versus a mega church where there's way more people now, but they may not know you as well. Like, I don't know which one would be more difficult. I guess that would depend on the person, but, there's definitely like a difference in the sort of the watchful eye, I guess you would say, of either of those experiences. Yeah,
for sure. I wonder too, so the youth pastor's kid experience is probably really different from mine as like the head pastor's kid. Was that something that was, you were like excited about, like it was like a cool part of your identity to be like, I'm the youth pastor's kid? Or was it something you were embarrassed by, especially those teenage years? What was that like?
Yeah, no, I think I was definitely, particularly when I was like real young, like before, because so my dad was my youth pastor for a few years in middle school. And then ultimately when he stepped into the family pastor role, there were other middle and high school pastors that I had. But all that to say, when I was, you know, younger, like elementary school age, it was awesome. I loved it because it meant that I got to hang out with these like cool high school kids. So like they, you know, regardless of whether or not they wanted to hang out with me, like I'm the youth pastor's kid. So like they kind of like their parents probably made them or, you know, whatever. So it was cool for that, but it was also cool. You know, when I actually got to middle school and high school, it was a weird thing to have my dad as my youth pastor for a while, but it was also, yeah. It sounds funny to say, but it is a weird sort of like big man on campus type deal. Like, yeah. I hate that those words come out of my mouth, but like it was this cool thing of like, oh yeah, my dad's the youth pastor. Like, mm-hmm. you know, sort of like, I don't know, status thing or whatever, which is so ridiculous. Right. But yeah, I guess. Yeah. I really enjoyed it. Mm-hmm. yeah. I don't really have like a negative impression of my time as the youth pastor's kid. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. I know. I definitely get that of feeling like, you know, feeling special because you're the, right. you know, the pastor's kid. That's always something. It can kind of go, some people are in the middle, but I always find there's kind of the far kind of sides of it. Some people are like, I hated it. It was the worst. Get me out of here. You know, yeah. Nobody look at me, that the kind of people like that. But I kind of enjoyed it. I felt like, especially, you know, at school, I was just like another kid. But when you're at church, you know, it's like everybody, even the grown-ups know who you are, you know, and that makes yep. you feel special.
Yeah, yeah, for sure.
Speaking of like those, the different kind of ways that you could look at and how you feel about your own experience as a pastor's kid. Did you ever know about any of the stereotypes growing up that pastor's kids were like either really rebellious or super sheltered? What was that like? And do you think you lived into any of them?
Yeah. You know, I felt like I heard the stereotype more of the rebellion, you know, the sort of like bucking against the system. I felt like that was more the stereotype that I heard growing up. I think that's mostly because like non-denominational megachurch, like there's not really a whole lot of sheltered folks around a non-denominational megachurch. But yeah, as far as living into one or the other, you know, I was just, you know, I was thinking about this as well, like in trying to think about my time as a kid. Like, I think all of it gave me a lane to fit in and like parameters that like insofar as I was able to remain inside of those boundaries, I was good. And I think that's where I was. Like I never really did anything rebellious. You know, I pretty much stuck to the rules. And I think part of it was, yeah, that sort of like, as long as you're within these, you know, boundaries, you're good to go. So yeah, in that sense, maybe there was a bit of sheltering. I mean, I talked to a lot of other people who grew up evangelical who weren't pastor's kids, who like, you know, weren't allowed to watch or read Harry Potter. Like that was a part of my upbringing, but like that wasn't really particular to my, you know, being a PK or anything. So like there were certain things that were like sheltered about my life. But I think that was just part of the evangelical, you know, subculture that I grew up around. Yeah.
Yeah, for sure. I remember that too, like other kids. I could read Harry Potter and watch the movies and all that stuff, but there were other kids that, some at church, and then I also went to private school. So at the private schools, my friend's mom was a librarian, and I remember how annoyed they were that they couldn't have the Harry Potter in the library at school because their parents had complained, you know.
Yeah.
Yeah. So were you were talking about boundaries that you kind of felt like, oh, as long as I'm within these kind of boundaries, were your parents part of reinforcing that? Or was it something you felt like kind of beyond outside of your parents, or were they like explicit about it?
Yeah, I think it was mostly, you know, a sort of structure set up by my parents. you know, and I honestly, like, I haven't had the conversation with them as, you know, I've gotten older, like whether or not they regret some of those like parameters, like, for example, again, like the sort of Harry Potter thing. Like, I wonder if now, like, if I were to ask them if they would like think that it was silly or, you know, like they were just trying their best. Like, so I think, yeah, it was mostly a structure put in place by my parents. And I think it was a structure that was done out of love. I think they were trying to do what they thought was best for me. And I think, I think it, again, like just the way that I'm wired, or perhaps this was a nurture thing, nature versus nurture thing that ultimately wired me. Like I was okay with that. Like I was okay with living within those parameters. And I never I never felt the need to like step outside of them because, I felt like if I did, I would disappoint them, or there would be shame or guilt associated with that. I'm an Enneagram 6, so I like to have my sort of security in a you know, a lane. So
mm-hmm. Yeah, that's funny. I wouldn't like. Do you think that your parents, because you went on to study theology, did your parents kind of think, like, was your dad like, oh, he's following in my footsteps? Did he have that in mind?
Yeah.
Is that your plan?
Yeah, it was, you know, I really, up until my senior year of high school, I didn't think that I would be going towards like theology or ministry of any kind. You know, I had dreams in high school of like becoming a high school English teacher, or even I thought about becoming a congressperson for a while, which I look back on now and I'm like, I could never do that. Mm-hmm. But yeah, I mean, once I entered into studying theology at Anderson, I mean, my dad and I were able to have theological, you know, conversations, and we still do. I don't want to jump ahead of any other questions that you might have, but like that in a sense actually has been kind of where I've started to step outside of the parameters now that, you know, I'm on my own, right? Like I'm starting to form my own thoughts and beliefs and opinions that eventually I hope to, you know, pass down to kids of my own. And, you know, I think there's definitely been changes that, you know, are different from what I believe now versus then. We still talk theology every now and then, but we don't see eye to eye on several things. So
that is a good question to skip to, because that's one that I ask is like, were you allowed to talk about your doubts and questions growing up? And then so that was one part of that question I can ask. And then the other part would be, what is it like now to have those disagreements with your dad? Is that like anxiety inducing, or do you feel like it's something you're both comfortable with, like kind of having a back and forth without feeling or worrying about him being disappointed in you or anything?
To the first question, I mean, I definitely, and this is one of the things that I'm really thankful for as far as my parents are concerned, is like that, yeah, it was very open, that if I had any questions, whether that was religious or theological or just, you know, life or, you know, what have you, that door was always open to ask the questions. What's funny is I don't remember being, and perhaps again, this is, you know, because I was such a like stick to my lane person, I never really like had doubts particularly. I loved the Bible. I loved the stories of the Bible, but I never questioned like, you know, were Adam and Eve real? Like that was never a question that I like thought of as a kid, or like, how did the earth populate with only two people? Yeah. Like those sorts of questions that like, you know, I guess people ask, but I never had those doubts, but questions in general were very open. That avenue is very open. As far as the conversations go and, you know, talking about my beliefs now. I would say the first time that I started to sort of voice the things that I was starting to believe and have now kind of solidified myself in, I would say that it was anxiety inducing in the sense of like the, like they didn't know. My parents didn't know that I was like forming these beliefs. And so once I like voiced them, that was sort of, yeah, anxiety inducing. But now it's almost like a joke, really. Like, you know, like for example, I would say, I'm a pretty committed Christian universalist. Like I'm committed to universalism, like as a theological idea. And like my parents, you know, sort of laugh at that now, like they find it funny and we can joke about it. But like when I was first, you know, forming that idea, it was tough to share that with them for fear of like, you know, disappointment or, you know.
Yeah. And it's like this greater, deeper fear potentially of like worrying about your soul and your salvation. If you believe in that, you know, it's like, I don't know exactly what they think about it, but I could see that would be a worry of mine, like talking through that kind of stuff.
Yeah. And how, yeah. Existential. Yeah. Yeah. That's what's difficult. Like, yeah. About theological questions, like, and other jobs, like if like, mm-hmm. yeah, nothing is quite as existential as talking and debating about what happens to us when we die and who's in and who's out.
Like, right, those are, exactly.
Those are big questions. And yeah, it's tough to have those conversations sometimes. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, for sure. There's an extra like weight to it all. I feel like.
Yeah, for sure. Yeah.
Is that something, it feels like that, the fear and potentially, I think shame is another big thing. Those are two really big things in American evangelicalism. So mm-hmm. what, I want you to talk a little bit about what you study in terms of evangelical like history, maybe like why you chose to study it and what specifically that you're getting out of it.
Yeah. So I would say mainly my focus and what I'm interested in with regards to evangelicalism is 20th and 21st century. And it kind of ties in with why I'm interested in it. I think so much of my, you know, upbringing was surrounded by so many pivotal places around evangelicalism. And I think it was so formative for me that I wanted to like explore it. And now, you know, considering myself, I guess what would be called an ex-evangelical, like there's another sort of bent to it where like now that I'm sort of out of it, there's a chance to be more objective, I guess, maybe. Yes, I don't know. I guess there's still ways in which biases enter in. But all that to say, yeah, so my main interests are in 20th and 21st century evangelicalism. You know, I wrote a paper recently for a class on the history of biblical interpretation on evangelicalism's approach to the Bible. And that was a really fruitful like research project to do because, like I mentioned, like I was so fascinated by the Bible as a kid. Like I memorized the passages and I memorized memory verses and stories and all these sorts of things. And, you know, that's one of the things that really led me away from evangelicalism is that approach to the Bible. I'm interested in exploring and researching it because I want to understand it as something that I grew up around and, you know, immersed in, but as something that existed also outside of myself. It's been such a formative, important movement in my life that I feel like I've always had some form of connection to that just, yeah, I can't imagine really studying anything else. It's just so interesting to me from mm-hmm. a personal perspective. Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, I get that too, like growing up within it and wanting to understand everything about like the why and the how that, you know, that Christianity in America, specifically evangelicalism, came to be as it is today, especially because in this last, you know, six or more years, it has become more and more prevalent in politics. And so it's affecting mm-hmm. people's real lives as opposed to just yeah. being this thing that's kind of way out there, you know? Right. And so, you know, taking it, people are starting to really think about evangelicalism and take it a little more seriously as something to analyze and to understand.
That's the other thing I think that is particularly interesting to me. You know, I had thought after grad or after my undergrad and going into the master's in philosophy, I did ethics. And so I wanted to explore ethics and politics. And now since coming to Duke, I've been really interested in church history and the history of Christianity. And so I would say that really most of my like later years of college and now have been surrounded by religion and politics. Like those are the two things that you're not allowed to talk about at the dinner table, but that I love right. more to talk about. And so, I would say that's the other reason for why I'm interested in exploring evangelicalism is because, especially now, you know, post 2016, but even, you know, in the new millennium, in the new century, like it is the, in many ways, such a pivotal force in American politics is, mm-hmm. you know, evangelicalism's, you know, relationship to politics.
Yeah. Yeah, for sure. When I was at ILEF School of Theology mm-hmm. in Denver, I was there 2015 to like 17. And right. so all this stuff is happening in the news and all of this like rising, you know, group of people that support Trump. And it's just like completely, you know, enveloped into American Christianity. And there was I don't remember, this might not have been back then, but that moment where Trump just stood there holding a Bible. Do you right. remember that? Yeah. I think that might've been 2020, but.
Yeah, I think that was during the George Floyd riots. Yeah.
Yeah, I think so.
Yeah, I'll never forget that. Yeah.
Yeah. People will be writing books about that, I feel like. It's just mm-hmm. There's so much going on behind the scenes with that. But I remember being, you know, in classes with people who were mostly kind of mainline and who were in the more progressive, like liberal kind of side of things, who don't interact with more traditional people that are on the more kind of conservative side, and evangelicals especially, they're just kind of this distant thing that there was like one class where we could study evangelicalism, you know? And so I became the person in my classes who had insight, you know. It's like I grew up in this world, and I'm especially, I think, mostly at the private school I went through in through high school, because that was non-denominational, and so it was basically, you know, Southern Baptist, like Reformed was the theology that I was being taught. And yeah. all the people that went to my school went to the mega churches kind of around town, and so I was like, all of this makes sense, everything that's happening with Trump and with a lot of these evangelical leaders like the Falwells and stuff like that. I was like, this mm-hmm. is like the next logical step. And so it's interesting how, I don't know, having that awareness of actually being inside of that world is really helpful. So I wonder, and I bet that you have that insight of being like, actually, I was there when these certain moments happened in history, and I know what people were talking about inside the church building because I was there and my dad was preaching about it, you know, or whatever it is.
Yeah. Yeah, I was having a conversation with somebody else here at Duke Div who, you know, is studying a lot of the same sort of stuff, you know, evangelicalism and all of that. And, you know, we were just having a conversation about like what it's going to look like for folks like us to study evangelicalism as ex-evangelicals, like to study the history and the phenomenon of evangelicalism as people who lived through it but no longer identify with it. I think that's going to be really interesting and hopefully fruitful.
Yeah, it's kind of like a firsthand account, you know. It could be really helpful if I could see. And that, I mean, we need that too. We can't just observe something from the outside and expect to think that we know everything, you know? And I see that with like churches, with a lot of the bigger kind of top down kind of churches. Like if you don't understand, like if say like you work in the big office for whatever denomination you're at, and so then you put out something that you think will be applicable universally to every church, it's like that's not going to work because you've got rural churches, you have urban churches, you have big churches, small churches. You can't just assume that everybody's going to be able to that you understand them and that you understand their needs, you know?
Yeah, for sure. Yeah, it's great.
Yeah. So going back to your pastor dad, what would you say is, like, tell me a little bit more about him and what is his style as a pastor? Something that I kind of learned in my undergrad was that there can be kind of two pastor styles that you can go between. One is being pastoral, like a shepherd, and the other is more prophetic, calling people to action. So what would you say is your dad's style? Where did he kind of land most of the time?
Yeah, that's an interesting question. I would say, you know, I'm thinking about the difference between him as a youth pastor versus him now. And in terms of the youth pastor, in terms of those categories, I'm not sure. You know, what immediately comes to mind as a youth pastor was, like, he wanted to, and this has become like such a negative adjective to use, but he wanted to be like relevant to the students. He wanted to like know the world that they were living in. And I think in many ways, funnily enough, like I was a part of that. Like I remember sometimes during the summer when he was working on you know, a sermon or something for the youth group, he would call me at home while I was home for summer vacation and ask, like, hey, is there a episode of, you know, such and such show that you're watching that you think might be, you know, applicable to this situation, you know, for him to use as an illustration or to pull a clip or something like that. So he definitely was at that stage as a youth pastor, like he wanted to, he wanted for his ministry to live the life of the students he was dealing with. And I think that was really respectable. Again, like we sort of think about relevancy or trying to be relevant as sort of a negative thing now, but I think he had good intentions with that. Now, I think especially with, you know, the missions and outreach stuff, I think he's really stepped into a teaching role that I don't think he had really had before now, which is really cool to see. I've never taken any of the trips with him, but I've been able to see like and hear from him about it. He does a lot of pastor training in different countries, which, yeah, I think is a really new sort of thing for him. But it's been cool to see him step into that sort of like teaching and equipping stage of his ministry. Yeah.
So does he takes people on like short-term mission trips, and then they probably have like connections with pastors at wherever countries and stuff?
Yeah, he definitely does that. He has trips that he'll take a group from the church on if they're interested in going. But I would say the main thing that he does, and this is actually something that I also really admire about, you know, his approach to missions and outreach, is he and the missions pastor that was there at the church prior to him, really both of them have this commitment to indigenous leadership, which I think is great. You know, in terms of like having someone on the ground there that does the pastoral work, who's somebody who lives there, who knows the culture, who lives the culture. And like dad goes over there, make sure that they have what they need, and really is pretty like hands off in terms of like the actual ministry there, and kind of lets them do their thing, which I think is really cool, the sort of indigenous leadership model. Yeah, they do have groups that'll go. I mean, he goes to all sorts of countries all over the world. So it would be hard for me to name them all out. There's several. Yeah.
Yeah. Do you think you'd ever go with him?
You know, I've never, since he stepped into this role, I haven't gone on any trips with him. Before, when he was the family pastor, he got the chance to lead a trip to Liberia, which is one of the countries that he currently still works with a missions partner there. And I was able to go with him in, I think that was 2013, 2014. So I was a senior in high school. So I was able to go with him then. But yeah, I would love to go back to Liberia. he at one point had a missions partner in Amsterdam. I think the person who was living there ended up moving here to the States. And so he doesn't have somebody in Amsterdam anymore, but I would have liked to have gone with him then. But yeah, unfortunately I haven't been able to go with him.
Yeah. The Church of the Nazarene is really big on missions. That's like something like the church tithes 10% and to the greater church, and then another 10% goes to missions. And so that was always been like a big part of my growing up in church was I think every 1 or maybe 2 years you get a missionary that you kind of like sponsor. You don't like send them money, but they're like the one person or family that you like pray for, and that if they come to the States, they'll come visit, kind of thing. And so that's always been like a big part of my upbringing. And we would always go to this one mission trip to Mexico. They did it every year around Christmas break. And so I did that a couple of times. And yeah, it's interesting, like short-term missions where you just kind of like go and then leave. I don't know if that's always the best, most beneficial thing to the people that you're trying to help, you know, but
Yeah, I mean, again, like that's what I find really respectable about their model that, you know, my dad has carried on from the person that was there in that role previous. Like there is a sort of, like a white savior complex sort of deal about short-term missions in many ways that I find the indigenous, you know, model is so much better for that.
And it makes me wonder if like kind of evangelical approaches to missions have been evolving, because that sounds a lot different than kind of when I was, you know, learning about it when I was growing up. Because that's the basis of like it's in the word evangelicalism. It's about evangelizing, spreading the message. And so missions, of course, would be a big part where you go into these other countries to save souls and to all of those kinds of things. And I think it could be done well if issues of like justice and empowerment and things like that were kind of on the forefront, you know, and there's people that, you know, have needs that need to be provided, which truthfully, a lot of the times, a lot of the countries that are impoverished, it's because of American imperialism and things like that. So it's this weird backwards, like so complicated kind of thing. And so it's such a difficult thing to kind of like think through and to wonder like what is the best thing that American Christians can do for people around the world, you know?
Yeah
What should we do?
Yeah, that's something that I've thought about a lot in my own study and thinking about like my dad's experience. Like missions is, like you were saying, like Christianity in general, but specifically evangelicalism, like that is the purpose, right? Like the whole purpose of Christianity and specifically evangelicalism is like the spread of the gospel. And I think something that I've been thinking about a lot recently, and I honestly need to do more readings in global and world Christianity. Unfortunately, because I'm so focused on American evangelicalism, I spend more time reading about the States. Yeah, that's something I've been thinking about a lot of like, is there a way to do global missions that is not in some form or fashion imperial or colonizing? Because by virtue of being, you know, a Anglo-American going to other countries in the global South, like how do you do that without being, you know, a white savior, basically?
Yeah.
Yeah, it's an interesting, it'll keep me up at night.
And then what about, I mean, because the other thing, at least with the evangelical, it's about saving souls, saving them from hell. But if you're, if you, as a universalist, what would be the value of missions for you? What do you think?
Yeah, I get this question a lot. And I think ultimately where I land, at least currently on that question, is that I think, you know, ultimately the gospel is still the greatest message there could ever be. The fact that there is a God who exists, who loves the people that he's made, and that, you know, as especially Romans 5 talks about, that, you know, while we were still sinners and hostile towards this God who loved us, he did such a radical thing as to, you know, give up his only son so that we could be reconciled to him. What better message is there? And I think, you know, that is so, that message that I've just presented, which I understand to be the gospel message, is so different and counter to what I grew up with and what you were just talking about. Like this idea that the gospel message is getting rescued and saved from hell. That is such a small, narrow view, I think, of what the ultimate Christian message is. That I think, you know, ultimately the purpose of missions and the purpose of the gospel is to let people know of the greatest story, the greatest message there is. I would be remiss if I didn't talk about my favorite theologian having this conversation, and that is Karl Barth. I've been a fan of Karl Barth since undergrad, and I think the way that he puts it is the best way that I've been able to think about it, that people who are quote-unquote non-Christians or quote-unquote unbelievers now are just, they are unaware. They have a veil over their eyes, and that the responsibility of missions is to lift that veil. It doesn't mean that the person is changed. Well, in a sense it does. In a sense they're aware now, but it doesn't change the reality of the fact that something has been done to rescue them. I think it's a totally different message than what evangelicalism often presents.
I like that a lot. I think to be revealed to you that you are loved and known and cared for and held by God can be something that can change your life here and now. And that's what I'm most interested in, is what is the gospel message for you in your life right now? Yes. And I think that it also means that the gospel works inside of people to make them go on to create a better world for other people and for themselves. And so it's also a call to action. It's a call to make the world better, to bring God's kingdom to earth, you know, which doesn't, you know, the kingdom of heaven is here. That means we have to act now. The kingdom of heaven is coming. We are part of creating that and building it in the here and now. And yeah. I think that's what I, thinking back on a lot of stuff growing up, is that everything is kind of looking off into the distance, into the future. You know, it's like, what about right now? How can the good news affect you right now? Yeah. And that's what I care about, you know?
Yeah, absolutely. You know, there's a New Testament scholar here at Duke that was part of the reason why I came here. His name's Dr. Douglas Campbell, and he talks about, like, he's been so formative for me and kind of coming away from evangelicalism, not in a negative way, but in a very empowering way of rethinking gospel categories of Christianity. But he says, like, basically, you know, if you believe Jesus is Lord and God loves you, you're good. Because, you know, I think about a lot of folks that I grew up with in evangelicalism, and even myself in many ways, are terrified constantly that they're in or they're not in. Mm. And ultimately, like Dr. Campbell says, like, if you believe Jesus is Lord and you believe that God has done something to rescue and redeem you, and you've believed that, you're good. Now get on with, you know, sharing that message with other people. And do something about it. Because ultimately then it becomes, if we're always concerned about our own eternal destiny, we're not concerned about the eternal destiny, and the lives for that matter of the people, you know, that we live around.
Right. Right. Yeah. Cause if your spirituality is always up in your head, then it has no value for me. I think, you know, if it's not changing the way you live and act in the world, you know?
Yeah. Definitely.
That's good. So to continue this kind of discussion about evangelical Christianity, one more question about what you're studying. Sure. Do you think there is any hope for evangelical Christianity as somebody who has left? What are the redeeming qualities? And do you think it will outlive the mainline Protestants? Because right now you're at a United Methodist school. The United Methodists they range from very mainline to pretty evangelical kind of across the board. But what do you think? What is your thoughts about that question?
Yeah, I was waiting for this question, and I've been thinking about it a lot since you sent the questions. You know, for me personally, I think where I currently stand right now, I don't see a whole lot of redeeming value, at least in, let me qualify this by saying, I don't think I see any redeeming value thus far in evangelicalism as it exists in America, in North America and the United States. I think there's a lot of cultural baggage that is bound up with that, be it politics, be it, you know, really politics. There's so much about, you know, the way that people think here in the States that's so different from the rest of the world. So that being said, you know, I think to some degree there is, and again, this is something that I want to explore more and read more global and world Christianity texts. I think in some ways there, it'll be really interesting to see, two things. I think it'll be interesting to see how the rest of the world outside of the States deals with evangelicalism. I mean, Pentecostalism globally is exploding. It is arguably probably, I think, going to take over Catholicism in terms of the most adherents globally. And Pentecostalism obviously has a lot of overlap with evangelicalism, particularly here in the States. But you know, I mentioned that paper that I wrote about evangelicalism's approach to the Bible, and I had a really, really difficult time writing the conclusion to that paper, because I was fine to present the research, present my argument that was basically my argument was that evangelicalism's approach with inerrancy to the Bible creates and produces a conservative approach to politics. And there's a reason why most evangelicalisms are conservatives politically, because they believe in an inerrant Bible. So all that to say, when I wrote the conclusion, I was like, well, what's the solution? And I think it'll also be really interesting to see Generation Z's approach to evangelicalism. Because not only is Generation Z politically arguably the most progressive generation the world has ever seen in terms of politics, but also inerrancy, and this is something that I think the ex-evangelical movement has influenced, and the emergent church movement has influenced. A lot of Gen Zers and late millennials don't really believe in inerrancy anymore. So these sort of really important evangelical American evangelicalisms, like these important tenets, aren't really believed so much anymore by younger folks. So I think in terms of that generation, Generation Z, and the rest of the world outside of the States, I'm really curious to see what evangelicalism's fate is, and whether or not it changes or survives. As far as outliving mainline denominations, yeah, I don't know. That's the other thing I'm interested about Gen Z, because, you know, particularly for folks my age, we're going back to the mainline. I go to a United Methodist school, but I identify currently as Episcopalian, and a lot of my friends are Episcopalian, and they're my age. They're not, they're not, you know, they're late millennials, mid to late millennials, and Generation Z. But I think it'll be interesting to see if that changes as we move more into Gen Z, if that turn from the mainline will go away. I mean, this is why I'm so interested in researching this, because who knows? Who knows what's going to happen? But I'm along for the ride, it'll be interesting. Yeah,
for sure. Yeah, there's like a joke I see on progressive Christian Twitter a lot, is the like evangelical to Episcopal pipeline. You
it's
know,
it's so true. Yeah.
Yeah.
It definitely happened for me. That is for sure. Yeah.
So do you like the kind of more high church vibes? You like sitting and standing and saying things all together and singing the hymns and stuff?
Yeah, I think liturgy at first was the main reason why I was sort of interested in the broader Anglican tradition. I started when I was in Greenville teaching at the school that I was teaching at, I started going to an American church, Anglican church in North America congregation, and quickly realized the reason why the Anglican church in North America exists is because they split off from Episcopalian, you know, the global Anglican communion and Episcopalians over same-sex marriage and ordination of women. And I mean, that's that ultimately now I think is where I'm at as to why I'm remaining in Episcopalianism is there's so much more open space. I think is so refreshing to come out of evangelicalism. And I think maybe that's why so many people my age are going towards the Episcopal Church from, you know, that pipeline exists from evangelical to Episcopalian is because evangelicalism is so rigid. And Episcopalianism, I feel like there's so much more opportunity to have an open hand, both towards people and towards theology and belief and, you know, all sorts of stuff. Yeah, it is really funny that there is such a pipeline. I think there's a reason.
Yeah, it makes sense. You know, people are looking for the space where that is affirming and that is open in those ways that really matter to them. Yeah. And then I think the worship style is kind of intriguing and it's fresh and it's new and specifically for evangelical ex-evangelicals. And so it makes sense that they would be drawn to that. And I definitely felt that too, like after college went to like a Lutheran church, that was very much, on the liturgical side and it was really cool. And I really enjoyed it. Yeah. It's funny actually, when I lived in Denver, I went to, do you know Five Iron Frenzy, the band?
Yes. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. They got a church that they formed or, you know, kind of really? Around them. Yeah. It's called Scum of the Earth. Nice. And it's in this really cool church that was owned by this artist who put murals everywhere. And so it's like this really zany building that's now a church again because he lived in it. And so anyway, but one of the pastors was an older guy the church all kind of started with him doing a Bible study with the guys from Five Iron Frenzy that evolved into this church. And I remember one sermon, he was talking about how he thought it was so interesting that everybody was really wanting to do more liturgical things. They wanted to sing, to, you know, to read daily prayers together and do the kind of things that are not typically seen in these kind of cooler, edgy churches that he would have thought. And he was like, in my day, he grew up Russian Orthodox. And he's like, we were leaving that for more evangelical modes of worship. We wanted something more freeing. We didn't want to have the rules. And now all of you guys that grew up with in that kind of space want to that structure back. And so I think that every generation we're going to flip, flop, you know, just like everybody living in cities. And then they're like, oh, we don't want that. We want the suburban life. And then everyone that grew up suburban is like, oh, I want city life. And we all just, right.
I think there's so much to that. And, you know, I think about like my parents, for example, like my dad went to the Willow Creek Leadership Summit conferences every year when we lived in Michigan, cause it was in Chicago. Like that was Gen X's vibe. Like they loved the modern mega church, you know, seeker sensitive sort of movement. I think now so now like us who grew up in it, we're going like, this is so shallow, we want something more. And I think that's one of the other reasons why I joined up with the Episcopalian church is like I wanted historic rootedness in something that I asked myself, because it's like, you know, the church that my dad works at now was formed in 1995, the same year I was born. It's like, there's no history there, right? Like, it's so new. But yeah, I think there's a lot to what you said that, like, I'm interested to see what Gen Z does as we progress more through their generation to see where they end up, if they even end up in church. I know that's some of the research that's going on too, of whether or not Gen Z is even going to be religious.
Right. Yeah. I think Christianity will survive, but I think it'll look so different, you know, even if all the churches we know it might be gone, but we'll find new ways, you know. it'll come out something different. Yeah. So last couple questions.
Sure.
If you were able to sit down with your younger self and have a little chit chat with little Cameron, whatever age you can pick, what would you tell him? What would you want him to know?
Yeah. What a tough question. A great question, but a tough question. I would say be prepared to be surprised. And by that, I mean, be prepared to, I think the me that grew up really through high school into going to college would look at myself now and not even recognize myself. Mm. The things that I believe, the things that I cherish, the things that I believe to be true, and not true. I would say to my younger self, like, don't be afraid to look at the now you. If it were me as I'm currently sitting talking to you today, talking to my younger self, I would say, like, don't be afraid of me and don't be surprised about where you end up. Because I think in many ways, where I am today is just a product of what I've been taught to believe. Christian universalism, for example, I think is just because I grew up hearing the gospel and I thought about what does the gospel actually mean. And so I think ultimately I would say, like, don't be shocked, don't be surprised at where you're going to ultimately end up and hang your hat.
Very cool. Do you think your younger self, would they be upset with you for becoming an Episcopalian?
Yeah, well, honestly, I don't even think that younger me would have even known what that is.
True.
I think so much of the world that I grew up in, like, I just assumed very wrongly that what I was what everyone else was. And I don't think I really had an awareness of other denominations, unfortunately. Outside of the ones that I was a part of, which is funny though, because I grew up in so many different denominations. But I think Episcopalianism was never one. I think there would probably be a sense in which, you know, my younger self would probably think that I had, you know, gone off the rails or become, you know, too liberal or something. I think there's a lot in me still that my younger self would go, yeah, I get it. Like, I understand where you're coming from because you still have these commitments. Because there's still stuff that I'm committed to, you know, as myself now that I was as a kid. So maybe it wouldn't be as shocking, but I think it would be shocking in some sense.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Maybe he would think it's boring.
Yeah, maybe. It's like, yeah.
Where's the drums?
this is one of my favorite stories to share from when I was a kid. We had the song Cartoons by Chris Rice.
Oh yeah.
What a cartoon.
I wish I could play it. It probably is copyrighted, but this song, I would love to be able to play it in the podcast. Yeah.
We had a guy who had a traveling puppet ministry who came and did a routine to that song. So I'm sure, like, younger me would be like, what does Episcopalianism offer? Like, we've got all the cool stuff. We've got the fun stuff. Yeah,
where's the puppet ministry?
Yeah.
That's so funny.
Yeah.
That's something, oh gosh, I wish we had more time to talk about all these different things, because that's something else about evangelicals is they like to kind of create their own version of, like, pop culture things that already exist. Yeah. So, you know, like Christian comedians, there probably aren't very many Christian comedians touring the mainline churches, but they're all over the evangelical ones, you know?
Yeah. Yeah. You know, I am also upset that we couldn't dive into that more because, like, yeah, so much of Christian media played such a pivotal role in my formation.
Yeah. You
know, Bible Man, The Donut Man, McGee and Me, like, all of these,
oh,
like,
my gosh.
All of these sorts of, like, focus on the family, like Adventures in Odyssey, all of these things had such a formative role for me as a kid. I would love to even explore that in my scholarship. I've thought about writing about, you know, children's media and evangelicalism when we were growing up. because
that would be big. Yeah.
Yeah. There's so many people that, like, you know, when I mentioned those, like, you just had the reaction, like, everyone's like, oh yes, I remember that. I love those. Like, they had a hold on us and they knew what they were doing. So,
yeah. I remember McGee and Me, I thought that was just a regular show. Like, I didn't realize that it was a very, very niche Christian thing, you know? And I remember when I did go to public school, talking to my friends about McGee and Me and this one, you've seen this one, right? And they're like, what are you talking about? I've never heard of that.
Yeah. Yeah.
It's like my little secret show that nobody else knew about except me.
Yeah.
Like,
yeah. The Harry Potter alternatives for me. Yeah.
Yeah. Wait, what was that? Harry Potter alternative?
No, I'm just saying, like, that was, was the sort of media I was allowed to consume instead of, like, Harry Potter Pokemon or, you know, that sort of stuff.
Yeah. I was hoping you meant there was, like, an evangelical version of Harry Potter, like, instead of a wizard school, it was like Bible camp or something.
there was an evangelical alternative to, like, Pokemon and anime, though. Some people remember it and some people don't when I talk to them. I remember this, though. Superbook. It was a Christian anime from, like, the late 80s, early 90s.
Marginally familiar. I don't think I ever consumed it or anything.
Yeah, that was, like, it was my only foray into anime because, like, Pokemon and Digimon were off limits for me. So
That's so funny. No Digimon? No. Were Pokemon, did your parents think Pokemon were, like, little demons or whatever was the thing that people were worried about?
Yeah, you know, like I mentioned, I would be interested to breach that conversation with them and find out, like, what was the reasoning. You know, I think there was such, and this would even be interesting to explore with Christian media, because I think this is the reason why those things exist, is, like, I think there was such an allergy in the media, particularly with focus on the family, to, like, magic and the occult and to, I mean, even frankly, foreign cultures, like, you know, anime in particular, you know, comes from Asian cultures. I think, I don't know. I really don't know the reason why I wasn't allowed to watch Pokemon, but.
Right.
Yeah.
I remember that being so, I mean, I was never ever into Pokemon, ever had any kind of interest, you know, but the one Disney movie my mom didn't like us to watch was Sleeping Beauty, because the queen, whatever her, Maleficent, the, you know, she's like a witch or something. And at one point she literally becomes this giant, like, creature in the sky and calls upon the powers of the deep and all these, like, things come out of the earth. And so my mom's like, that's demonic. Like, at least it's too dark for my kids. And so we never got to really watch that one. It wasn't that bad though. I mean, I'm sure I'd have to look at it now, but it's fine.
Yeah.
That was, like, the one thing. Oh no, wait, I just remembered. My dad really never liked when we would watch, more when we were older, when we would watch Golden Girls. Because this old lady, I think it was the idea of old ladies having sex and dating was like, my dad was like, no, they're too promiscuous. They're not supposed to be like that. He didn't like that one. But we would watch it with my mom when my dad wouldn't help. Don't tell. Okay. Well, one last question. What advice can you give to pastors' kids who are raising their own pastors' kids?
Oh, wow. I really don't know. I would say ultimately, I think I'm glad for the example that my parents left, that even though they were strict, I knew what they did was because they loved me. And I think ultimately, you know, that's something I've heard a lot of people that have been guests on your podcast have said to this question. And I think there's a lot of truth to it, that ultimately, like, as long as, and I mean, this goes for really any parent, but, you know, particularly, I guess PKs. Yeah. As long as your kids know that you love them and that, that you're always in their corner. I think that's super important. Even when, perhaps things don't turn out, or your kids maybe don't turn out the way that you might suspect that they will or hope that they will, that you're still in their corner and you still love them. I don't know. That's such a tough question. I don't have any kids of my own, so I don't really have to think about these questions currently. But yeah, I guess that's what my answer would be.
Yeah, that's a good answer. Good answer. So is there anywhere that people can find you online or support you in any way? Are you still on TikTok, anything like that?
Yeah. So let's see, probably the best place that I post about, you know, what I'm reading or what I'm studying and any like papers that I write or publish, that would probably be on my Instagram, which is at the Hepster, H-E-P-S-T-E-R, like hipster, but Hepala. And let's see, I'm on Twitter. I don't use it as much as I used to, but it exists out there in the world. And I post some stuff about scholarship on there as well. That is, I think that's just my name with no spaces or no hyphens, just Cameron Hepala, at Cameron Hepala. And my TikTok, like I said, I don't really use it anymore, but you know, I don't know if people want to go on there as an archive or something for whatever reason. I think it's, at Mr. Hepala Teaches Bible. It's either Mr. Hepala Teaches Bible or Teaches the Bible. I'd have to go verify that. But yeah, I would say primarily my Instagram is what I mostly use. I post on my stories a lot just about like books I'm reading or thoughts I'm having in studying and scholarship research stuff. And hopefully I'm writing a paper right now, working on a paper on segregation academies. Which is a phenomenon that happened a lot after the Brown v. Board decision integrating and desegregating public schools in the 50s. A lot of white Christian parents, especially in the South, created private Christian schools to keep from having their kids go to integrated public schools. So I'm working on that paper right now and hoping that it's going to be published because I'm working on it particularly as it relates to where I'm from in Greenville, South Carolina. And so I'm hoping to publish that. So if it does get published, then I'll post about it. So yeah, that's where people can find me.
Ooh, that's a big part of evangelical history people don't like to talk about, but it's a part of it. An important part.
So true.
A lot to do with the rise of the Christian right and things like that. It's all happening at the same time.
Yeah. Mm. Yeah. I'm
excited for when that comes out.
Yeah. That's the last thing that I can say just real quick. That's been one of the most interesting things I've found in my research is that most people think that evangelicalism became Republican because of Roe v. Wade. And that's just not the case. Evangelicalism became conservative because of desegregation, and they found that Roe v. Wade and abortion was the way that they could rally people. But it all was because of race and the civil rights movement. So there's a lot of scholarship and books that people can look to with that topic. It's really fascinating.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And is that not true of like basically every piece of American history, everything that goes wrong or any bad thing, you're like, you get back far enough, racism. That's what it is.
That's so true.
Well, any closing thoughts?
I don't think so. This has been a blast. I've really enjoyed talking. And I find this podcast really cool. I mean, your episode that you just did with Semler and the episode that you did with Jim Baker's son is fascinating too. So, this is a really cool thing you're doing. And I'm really like appreciative that you allowed me to be a part of it.
Yeah, of course. I'm really glad that I got to sit down with you. This was a really awesome conversation, so I appreciate it.
Yeah, thank you.
And for everybody listening, thank you for joining in on this episode of Pastor's Kid. If you enjoyed this conversation with Cameron, share it with a friend and give it a rate, review, and subscribe. You can follow Pastor's Kid on Facebook, Instagram, and Twitter, and find us anywhere you listen to podcasts. Our theme music is Brushmaster by Ure. You can find him on Spotify and Apple Music. I'm your host, Piper Ramsey Sumner. See you next time.